Vayetze, the story about very interesting story over here. Yaakov's marriage to Rachel. What strikes you as being interesting about it? If you take a look at the whole manner in which Yaakov encountered Rachel is very interesting. We'll skip that for the time being. He sees her by the well, and as soon as he sees her, he removes the stone from the air and so forth. We'll just leave that for the time being. But clearly, he says that he cried. He kissed her and he cried. It seems clear that as soon as he saw her, he realized that she would be the perfect choice, obviously. Seemed that way. Then she goes and she calls the father. Take a look at the Chavtet, Bereshit Chavtet, Yud Gimel. So he gets a very warm reception from Lavan. Alright? Because the Yaakov tells Rachel, he was the relative of her father and the son of Rivka, and she ran and told her father. Then when Lavan heard the news about Yaakov, the son of his sister, his nephew, so he ran out to meet him. And he hugged him and he kissed him. Very warm reception. Extremely excited to see him. And he told Lavan everything. He gave Lavan an account of everything that had happened. All right. There's interesting Rashi's over here. Rashi is very critical of Lavan and this whole thing. Very strange. In fact, he goes through a strange extreme. That hugging him, he was feeling for money. You know, he was feeling for money. But he remembered when the servant had come, he had come with a lot of money. But Rashi reads, you know, he has Midrashim on all the implications. He reads implications into all the words to paint to Lavan in the worst possible light. Even when he kissed him. Because he was according to Rashi, Lavan was disappointed that he came empty-handed. He was expecting somebody to come as well. Alright, well, I'm really focusing on that aspect right now. The Rashi says even when he kissed him, he thought maybe he's got the gold hidden in his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds a little strange, and that's a little bit of a... How do you understand such a Rashi? How does it fit into the plain meaning of the psukim? The plain meaning of the psukim is certainly not the intention. So it's a good exercise in how to take a medrash. What the medrash, how the medrash weaves into the... Where does Rashi get that in the pasuk? How does it tie into the pasuk? Anyways, in terms of that hidden, Rashi obviously means that, I would say, take a look at Rashi over here. I mean, it's important to study the Rashi carefully because very often a person studies the Rashi and it substitutes, in his mind, he substitutes what Rashi is saying for the plain meaning of the story. I don't know if that's the way it's problem, because the plain meaning of the story, Lavan's behavior is exemplary. Because he ran out, he heard the news. He didn't hear anything about wealth. He heard the news about Yaakov, that Yaakov had come, and he ran out to greet him, and he hugged him, and he kissed him, and he brought him to his house. So he treated him in a very nice way. Wouldn't seem right that he should be criticized. But Rashi... Take a look at Rashi, Vayaretz L'Kvato, and he ran out to meet him. So he quotes, by the way, this is Rashi's not making this up, this is from the Medrash. Kasavar, he thought Mamon who was torn. He thought that he was carrying money. Share Evid Abayas Ba Lakan, Basar Gamal Mtunim. Because the servant of the house had come, he remembered, of course, when Eliezer had come in search of a wife, Rivka. His sister Rivka, and he remembered the great wealth that he had brought. So Rashi says, this is the way Rashi breaks it down. So Rashi, he ran. Why did he run? He ran not because of Yaakov, but he ran because of the money. You see, this guy's got a lot of money. Bayachavek, and he hugged him. So what does it mean he hugged him? Rashi says, Shlo ro'im o klum, when he didn't see that he had anything. So apparently he was disappointed, according to Rashi. Amar, he said, Shema zehuvim hevi. Vihina mecheka. Alright, maybe, because the other person brought it on camels, but maybe he's got gold, jewelry, things that aren't, you know, to be brought, and he's carrying it in his bosom for protection. Okay. Therefore he hugged him. That's funny, I mean, that's just sort of like his real purpose is to pat him down, you know, to frisk him. That's sort of it's amazing the extent to which he measures his change in the book. Well, he's hugging him, right? You're reading the story on the plane level, and it's nice. He's a relative. He's happy to see him. Rashi is real. Rashi is very cynical over here. He's actually patting him down. He's frisking him. So one second. That's when hugs him. Then he kisses him. Rashi's not finished with him yet. By Inashek Lo, Amar, he said, because now apparently he was disappointed. He patted him down and there was no money over there. So he didn't stop there. Now he kisses him. Shema Zehuvim, excuse me, by Inashek Lo, Amar, Shema Goliath, Hevi. Maybe he's got some gems, the Haim Bethiv, and he's hiding them in his mouth. That's going a bit far. So basically, simply it means he told them the history of what had happened. That he left his house and he came here and everything. But, alright, there's different interpretations. How much did he tell them about his past? Well, according to the Sforno, he says, Vayisaper the Lavan. See, he shows you a lot of, it's not even clear what the plain shot is. Well, what did he tell Lavan? Ace Kolad Varameela, all of these things. What are these things referring to? So, this Furnace says, Vayisaper the Lavan. He told him, Lodio Shaloboilov, Lasar Parnasa. He told him that he hadn't come to him because he needed sustenance for Parnasa. Elohim Molet Meyachav. Except to he ran away from his brother. So according to the Sforno, he told him about the underlying, the real reason he had come was to escape from Esav, the Sheb Mitzvah Imo Yashav Imo, and that it was at the urging of his mother, the command of his mother, that he had come to him. Okay, so that makes sense, because he had to give an explanation as to what he was there for. Why did he come? But according to Rashi, Rashi says that there's a deeper implication, because Rashi's fitting everything into the basic premise that Rashi has laid down, that Lavan was really searching for his money. So according to Rashi, by Yisapil Lavan, Shalom Ba Elamitov Ones Echav. He told him that he, the same thing, that he only came because of the fear of his brother. Vishenatlo Mamono Imeno, and that he had taken his money from him. Because Rashi brings out another message that Esav had sent out his son Eliphaz to go get him.
Mm-hmm.
And Eliphaz had cornered Yaakov. So in other words, according to that medrash, Yaakov had left with money. But Eliphaz was after him and he tried to dissuade. Now Eliphaz apparently wasn't the Russia. And he had a certain respect for Yaakov. He didn't really want, he was instructed to kill him by Esav. According to the Medrash. And Yaakov told him that he shouldn't do it, it's the wrong thing, and so forth. So he agreed, but he says, what am I going to tell my father? And so he said, see, I take all my money and tell him that you took all my money, that ani is chashuk to me. The person without money is like he's dead. Which makes sense according to Esav's philosophy, right? A person It says, that term is used, by the way. Where do you see an open expression of that idea? At the Medrash, that an ani, a poor person, is considered to, is like someone who's dead. It's like he's dead. There's an open expression. It doesn't mean it philosophically, by the way. The Torah doesn't mean that. That sounds like a materialistic philosophy of life. That's not what the Torah means. In a materialistic society, right, where, you know, money is everything, so then the person made that statement, that would be an expression, true expression of the philosophy. But according to the others, in fact, we say quite the contrary, that aniyas could be a beneficial thing spiritually. Because also, may aniyah Yisrael yekin Torah, that the true Torah scholars do not come, generally speaking, from the wealthy. They come from the poorer, from the poorest segments of society. Because the wealthy people, the wealthy people, by and large, don't have the same drive to learn. Because wealth is not necessarily a blessing. So whenever we pray for wealth, it's always in conjunction with Torah. But the only benefit of wealth is that it should be used properly. But the ideal itself of becoming wealthy, that wealth itself is a good, that's not part of the object. That's not true at all. In point of fact, it's not a good because it's just a means. But if anything, I've spoken about this many times, it causes more problems for a person. More people suffer because of, if they achieve like a significant type of wealth, it's harmful. It's more harmful spiritually.
By the way, you say studies of people who are on the bottom.
It does say, the Torah does have an open expression of this idea in Shemot. Because, according to Rashi, when God told Moshe, Leishuv Mitzrayimah, return to Mitzrayim, He mesu kol anoshim hamavakshim es nafshecha. Because all the men that are seeking your destruction have died. What does it mean? What was it referring to, according to Rashi? He mesu kol anoshim.
Lost the power.
It's referring to Dasa, who was seeking the destruction of Moshe. Dasan and Aviram. We discussed this on Shabbos. They were the ones who had snitched on Moshe. They were the two Jews who were fighting amongst themselves, and Moshe had come to intervene, and they turned against Moshe. They said, "You're a lawbreaker. Who are you? Who appointed you with his laws in this country? You killed the Mitzri. We're going through their reporting." And then Moshe said, "Achei no da'adav. Now I see the corruption of the Jews themselves. I see why they're being enslaved." But according to Rashi, Kimesu Kohan Hashem is a reference to Dasan and Aviram, that they are the ones who died. But the truth is they had to die, because they continued to afflict them in the Midbar. So Rashi says, Yardim min chasam. They lost their wealth. And that's equivalent to death. What do you mean they lost their wealth in the fulfillment of the Torah? It means that, in a certain sense, in the social order, in terms, you see, it does function. Even though philosophically it's not a virtue, it's not a value, and there's no reason why a wealthy person has a... People do make that association now. They assume that if a person has wealth, then he's superior. He has a certain superiority. He has a certain wisdom. So they lost their influence.
He
may still call Anasha means they lost their position, they lost their influence. So, practically speaking, they are dead in the sense that they can't harm you. In that sense, that's what Yaakov, so he understood the psychology of Esav. That Esav wanted to kill him, it didn't mean that he had to be physically dead. It means he wanted to destroy him. So that he was envious of him. Because he thought that he was the chosen one. That he had the fantasy that he was searching for. Of course, that all centered around the material. So when he gave away his money, he knew that that would appease Esav. Because in Esav's eyes, it's like he's dead. There's no hatred anymore. There's no hatred against the physical person. It's what he represents to him in his mind. So Yaakov represented something. And that what he represented was the individual who would have the blessings that he was searching after. That same fantasy. So therefore he gave him the money. And he told him, now you can tell him the truth. Now you can tell him that he really killed me. Because as far as he was concerned, that was the fight. That was what he really wanted. That was the destruction that he wanted. Anyway, to get back to Rashi's interpretation, let's get back to where we started. Now, how do you understand all of this? How does Rashi deviate? Is that really true? We have to ask ourselves the question, is this really true? The Medrash must have truth to it, but the Medrash can't supplant the Pasuk. If you read the Pasuk, we read about an individual who's behaving in a very cordial manner, as would befit a family member, an uncle, and his nephew who he hasn't seen, but he never saw before. This is the first time he's ever seen him. Has come to him, and he hears. He doesn't even wait for him to come to his door. He hears from his daughter that the person was in the vicinity, and he runs out to greet him, and he hugs him, and he kisses him, and he invites him into his house, and he stays with him for a month. Then after a month, he welcomes him to stay longer. All right, and he says, "Tell me what your wages are." He offers him a parnas. On the surface, it's very hard to criticize what Lavan is doing. Yeah. So that's one interpretation. But here comes Rashi with a completely different interpretation. So now we have the Pasuk, now we have the Medrash, and how do the two come together? We have two separate accounts. The Medrash, the explanations of the rabbis, they can enhance, they can elucidate, but they cannot supplant the plain meaning of the text. Now that's what I'm always, one of the things I tried to emphasize in the study of Chumash, how to understand the Medrash. Because you find that people learn these Medrash, and they're taught these Medrash as children, and then the Medrash becomes the reality. And the Medrash now becomes the truth. This is what happened. This is what occurred. Without any attempt to, it seems that there's a deeper idea, and also you can't just negate, you can't negate the text. It has to somehow go back into the text. What's going on over here? So let's just start off with that as a problem. How do you understand? What is this Medrash teaching us? If we're going to take the Medrash literally, then this guy's a knave. Anyway, this is the lowest of the low. It's one thing to come out with the expectation that maybe this guy's bringing some money. Alright, so you look around, you admire, he comes in a nice car, whatever it is, that's one thing. But to go so far as to say that when he saw that there was no external expression of money, he actually, every time he shook his hand, he was really going up his sleeve, you know, like he hugged him, he was looking in his pockets, you know? It's like a hard thing to understand. Doesn't seem to be the case. If that's the case, then Yaakov would have reacted. You know, like, why doesn't the Torah record that? Or why does the Torah record it in such a the Torah should have alluded to it. You know, that he was looking for his money, some kind of, exactly. If that's the case, so then the description of Lavan would have been a little bit negative. Maybe the Torah wouldn't have brought out all the details, but it would have been pretty obvious that he was angry with him, or that he wasn't that friendly. There would have been something in the record itself. So we have to ask ourselves, why is the written version so completely different from, you know, the story itself is presenting one type of a personality, and the Medrash is presenting a totally different kind of a personality. There must be a reason for that. Let me ask you a question. Well, what do you guys have a question? Was this a calculated move to frisk him, or were these really ag gestures of friendliness? Now, if you read the Pesukim themselves, it does not seem that it was a calculated move, that he planned all this to find out if he had money. So there was friendliness. Now comes Rashi and says it was really calculated. How do you blend the two ideas together? Two separate ideas. This idea happens very frequently. You know, when you're in social situations, you meet somebody. So you're nice, you're friendly, and so forth. And you're a friend, but that doesn't exclude another possibility. In the back of your mind, you know, you learn certain things about him. He has certain influences, certain positions, so you, maybe not even consciously, but in the back of your mind, it makes an impression. This person might be useful to me. That also makes everything, you know, the mind can embrace many ideas. You want to be friendly, you like him, and so forth, but also you might even need that. That's why friendships after many years can hit a snag. All of a sudden, you can become tremendous enemies. But I thought you really, the friendship had certain, apparently there were certain selfish elements that were there all the time. They never had an opportunity to come forth. Now, when you need a specific favor, and you thought that this guy, and you had put a lot of energy, you didn't realize how much energy you put into that relationship. You thought it was because you really liked him. You didn't realize it was a part of your mind was doing it, was motivated by the fact that you thought you could get something out of it. Now you can't. That's one thing. But this is different.
You know,
the point that Ben is making, you see, Rashi, everything fits together, because in the description of Lavan's encounter with Eliezer, the Pesach makes it clear. See, because first Eliezer encounters, you know, the famous test that he gives her, where she would she'd give him water and then she'd offer some water all the time. Like, and then it says that the young girl ran, this is in Bereshit, Tav Dalet, and she told it over to our household, these words. She didn't say specifically to Lavan, but then it says Rivka had a brother, his name was Lavan. And Lavan ran to the man, he's the one that ran. You see, right away, she just reported this to the entire family, but one person ran. And now we have to know, why did he run? Because it could be he ran because he was such a practitioner of Chesed, or it could be a different reason. So it says that when he saw the earrings and the jewelry, the rings on the hands of his sister, And then when he heard the words, first he was impressed by the wealth. Then he heard the words of Rivka, who was saying, this is what the man said. In other words, that he was from the family. Then he came to the man, and he was standing by the camels. And the camels were laden with wealth. So clearly, he was motivated because of what he had heard about the wealth. Then he says, come, one who is blessed of God. Why? Then he invites him in. Anyway, so it's clear, I mean, that this was the personality of Lavan. And that's what Rashi based himself on. So now when Yaakov, he heard about Yaakov, who was from the same family, he remembered the tremendous wealth. Okay. So that makes sense. But what I'm trying to focus in on is how Rashi breaks down every move that he made and tries to say that in every particular move he had a double purpose. Isn't that stretching it a bit too far? Why can't we simply say that Lavan was an individual who was a materialist, and he liked money, and when he encountered wealthy people, he was drawn to them because he tried to get a part of that money. Yeah, Hardy's making a good point in that the way he looked at Yaakov was complex. He's the type of person who wanted to benefit from other people's wealth. I mean, that's for sure. But there was a certain respect for the person of Yaakov. I mean, he wants to learn about him, to learn about his ways and so forth. Of course, maybe for different purposes, not because he doesn't want to emulate his real righteousness, but insofar, I would say it like this, insofar as he views him as being a success, what this type of person wants to do is to co-opt somebody else's success. He wants to take it over and make it a part of himself. That's what this personality wants to do. Well, of course, it first of all expresses itself with regard to the person's money. That's a predator out there in society that is looking to co-opt what others have produced. You find it not only in the financial situation, you find it also in the intellectual person as well. I mean, it's a lot on the universities, amongst professionals, you know, stealing ideas and so on and so forth, trying to, or with subtle changes, to take over. You always have this big blockade sometimes. But who got the idea first? Who wrote the book? Who was the whose discovery? And a lot of times students and teachers. So they will co-opt. They'll learn enough of the method, and then they want to. They're only doing it because they want to achieve their own independent fame. And then they'll make certain changes to try and disguise it, and they'll present it as though it's their own. So you're saying that he was really curious about the person, right? He wanted to find out what made this person tick. What he had. Yeah. Okay, that's true. I would say like this though. I would say that both ideas are true. That the Rashi, there's a truth. The personality, Lovin is very much like a contemporary personality. You know, these people that get involved in all these different social circles, and they present, you know, they're masters at presenting a certain face, of being friendly. Like you go to these social gatherings, yeah, politicians, but it's not just politicians. Because politicians, everybody knows. No one takes politicians seriously, right?
Well, I'm
saying even ordinary people that have the, you know, socialites. These socialites, and when they're, you know, like always saying sweet things about the other person, how wonderful you are, and they love you. Only they go to the extreme. They go to a certain extreme of friendliness. You know, have these parties and darling, you're wonderful, and this and that, praise. That type of thing. Of course, beneath it is baggage. Now, he was an individual. See, what made him dangerous was because he's capable of hiding his true nature. His real objective was to exploit whatever he could. What he saw in Yaakov was an individual who was ripe for exploitation, but that he had to keep completely hidden. So the pasuk is saying how he behaved. He behaved in that manner in which he was able to display a certain friendliness. And I would say the pasuk is saying what makes this person effective is because it does not come across as being phony. It doesn't come across as being phony. See, a politician is something else. A politician is, it's not easy. Not every politician has this knack. Some of the really successful ones, because even though you know he's a politician, the really successful ones, they have a way of doing it that when they speak to you, you really do feel the emotion. That's what makes them successful. They're very good at that. Even though in the back of your mind, you know he's only doing it because you're a voter, but they're so good at it that for that moment they make you feel that it's real. That's a successful con of. I would say that's what the pasuk is telling us. There's nothing else, but you'd think that a person like that would be sophisticated, so he'd be friendly, and they just bide his time. The way to do so is to simply bide your time and just wait. I think what Rashi is saying is that, on the other hand, he's extremely, when you have those emotions, the underlying the behavior is one thing, that was a facade, which meant you have to suppress. Yeah, Lovin was in a situation where you have to suppress his basic emotions. When you suppress your emotions, they have to express themselves in a certain way. So as crazy as it sounds, it is true that he couldn't refrain. That Wiley was actually involved in embracing him, he really was. A part of him was searching for the money. It didn't, in other words, in an ever so subtle way, he was. Don't think that is too petty. Don't think that he just forgot about all these monetary considerations, and he's just going to bide his time and we'll see what happens. No, at the very moment of the encounter, he's involved in searching. That emotional need to find out about this person has to manifest itself. And every act that he did, it manifested itself. And that sounds so petty and so crazy that he'd be searching, even maybe he's got the money. Yes, that thought would cross his mind as well. That thought would cross his mind as well. He was frustrated. He was frustrated in the fact that there was no obvious sign of wealth over here. So that frustrated him, that bothered him, and that was a motivation as well. He had two motivations. You see? That's what I think Rabbi Rashi is saying, is that once a person has this type of an emotion, it doesn't leave him. And it's not suppressed. And he can't even control it that well. It'll come out. And it came out, he had to have a certain satisfaction. He had to have a certain immediate satisfaction. His curiosity, he had to find that immediately. And it could express itself even in the craziest way. Well, maybe I'll hug him. Maybe he's got money over there. I'm not saying this is a conscious phenomenon. On the conscious level, this is the way he was behaving because he wants to create a certain impression. You see? But that is the personality of our time. The person who socially has is acting in one way, totally, totally friendly, only cares about and so forth, and the reality is the exact opposite. But that reality of the exact opposite can't be totally suppressed, and it's going to manifest itself. It's going to manifest itself. And interestingly enough, you see that, we'll take it up tomorrow, Yaakov was suspicious of him. Yaakov was very suspicious of him. And what I want to go into is the manner in which Yaakov was deceived. Because that's an interesting question. How did he deceive him? With regard to what? How could you fool a person with regard to something like that? How could a person make a mistake in an area like that? And how did Laban manage to get away with it? Why did Yaakov confront him? Yaakov did confront him, but yet he was able to work his way out of it. How did he do it? It was trickery. We'll take that to mind. Like this. The psukim are describing the overt behavior. Now that overt behavior, we would know from the whole personality of Laban that it wasn't done out of a true emotion of love. It was done because of ulterior motives. But Rashi is pointing out that those ulterior motives will express themselves in the very act itself. They can't be totally suppressed. Even if that's right, as crazy as it sounds, that it means to say that he can't withdraw from those emotions, withdraw from those emotions, and then forget about that, and you'll say, exactly, he couldn't suppress it. The lust, when a person is overcome by a lust, he can't suppress it, and as soon as he sees, no matter how hard he tries, as soon as he sees the object of the lust, he's got to have some, he can't wait, what did he bring me? That thought, which to you is very petty and does not seem to be in line with a sophisticated person, that's not true. He is a very petty person. He acts sophisticated, but it's like he can't wait. Why don't you wait till you get to the house? The same personality as a kid, like when the parent comes home on the birthday and he doesn't see any presents. So the kid runs outside, the father gets out of the car, right? And, you know, when you get a little bit older, you wait. Sure, wait till when your husband and wife are ready, you wait till you try and control yourself. You wait till you get inside at least, But it's a kid, as soon as he sees his father, and the father is like stretching out his hands, what did you bring me? He doesn't see the gift, he gets extremely upset. What did you bring me? You see? Now you'd think that an adult is beyond that. No, he's not beyond that at all. It means that he was motivated by the same thing. What did you bring me? What do you got? He couldn't suppress that feeling, and that feeling needed a certain gratification immediately, even while he was engaged, even though it ran counter to his plan. Because in terms of his plan, the best thing is to ingratiate, forget about that, and now just be friendly, and we'll say. But no, the emotion needed an immediate gratification. All right, today we'll take a brief look at Vayishlach. Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim Lefanov, and Yaakov sent messengers before him. Of Esav Achiv to his brother Esav, Arsha Steyer, the land of Steyer, Stey Edom, the field of Edom. Okay, so this is the story of the encounter between Yaakov and Esav. As we know that Yaakov had left in the first place because of his fear that Esav would kill him, and now he's returning, and it would appear that he anticipated that he'd be having an encounter with Esau. So this is sort of a preempt, because this is a question I'm not going to take up right now. The Ramban discusses it. Ramban criticizes Yaakov for this. That Yaakov should not have gone out of his way to arrange this meeting with Esau. He's critical of him. Take a look at the Ramban. The plain sense is that this was the correct thing for Yaakov to do, because he was anticipating. Well, it's hard to understand that. I was at a question more on the Ramban. In ordinary terms, it makes sense that he was acting practically. He would have to deal with Esau. So why wait until he was in a weak situation? So he sent messengers ahead to try and avert
the danger. In other words, he assumed that there's going to be a showdown, and he wanted to avoid it. He wanted to prepare for it. He sent messengers, and he commanded them, and he told them what to say. This is, thus shall you say to my master Esau. Notice the, every term is important, to refer to him. They were instructed to refer to him as my master Esau. This is, and to refer to Yaakov as his servant. So he's relating to him in a, from a position of some type of subservience. Thus speaks your servant Yaakov or something. In love on Garki, this is what you should tell Esau, my master Esau. Thus speaks your servant Yaakov. In Lavan Garki, I have sojourned with Lavan Va'echar Adasa, and I have tarried until now. Ramban takes that point up. He says, Kosomron Ladon Lueso. This is what, Tani's right, you read the Pasuk literally. The Pasuk is saying, this is what you should tell my master Esau. So, that would be even stranger, because why is he... I can understand. It makes more sense that this is part of the instruction, that when you speak to him, refer to him as my master. But that's not the translation. The translation is that he told his men, this is what you should say to my master. Now why did he have to? That doesn't make any sense. That would be problematical. Because that would not even be truthful. He didn't. Did he regard Esau as being his master? And did he regard himself as being his servant? That's a distortion of the situation. It would make sense diplomatically. Diplomatically, we always use dissimulation. We always use terms that we don't really mean. It's part of the game of diplomacy. But, okay, so therefore, in addressing Esau, you have to use terms that weren't 100% truthful. But here he's speaking to his own men. So Ramban says, Tiva osam sheyomru la'adoni la'esav anachnu shalom o'shluchem elav, or we are sent to him, v'leymar lo. The first chat is that this is what the way we learn, that this is what you should say to him. Say to him, ko amar avicha, this is what your servant Jacob said, in love and garthi. He says, or it's possible to say that Yaakov actually referred to Esav in this way as his master to remind them that they should not refer to him, even not in his face, except in a manner of honor, because they would see that their master referred to him as Adoni, as my master. Means like this, that the plain shot is that Vayitzav Osam Lemo, everything after that is deceivable. This is what they're supposed to do. In other words, refer to Esav as my master, and so forth. The second shot is like you say, that no, that when he spoke to them, he referred to Esav that way. That's because he was being more careful. He's being more careful. But there's a point over here that, you see, there's a psychological factor. How you relate to somebody, your assistants or your students, etc., will pick up on it. So that sometimes, if you want your students or your assistants, whatever, to demonstrate respect to someone. Now, if they know that you really don't respect this person and they're just going through a charade, so then it's not going to be as effective, because they don't really believe that you feel this way, so they're less likely to be careful about it. But if they sense that you too are really very careful about this and you won't show any disrespect, it's going to have a greater effect upon them. That's what the Ramban is saying. That he was if you want to learn that that's the way he actually referred to him, then he did so for a reason, because they would see that he's not joking, he's serious about this. In other words, this is the point that comes through, this is the lesson that comes through, that sometimes it's necessary, sometimes when you're dealing with something that's important, and you regard it as important, but even though you regard it as important, you sort of are relating to it in a relaxed kind of a way. You have that situation very often at the wedding. Very often under the chuppah, everybody's making all kinds of jokes. Yeah, about the ring, or this, or the war. Yeah, because there's serious halachic issues going on in terms of the witnesses inspecting the ring, and then they're supposed to ascertain that it's worth at least a shelah puta. A shelah puta would be like a penny for it. And that sounds, you know, so people, and you have to go through a procedure, you know. You ask the rav, who's the Masai Kedushin, he asks the chasm if it belongs to him, to be purchased with his own money. So everybody, you know, people approach these things in a certain mood of frivolousness. So, you know, there's all kinds of comments and jokes and, you know, that type of thing. And I know that when I'm dry chated these things, he frowns upon that. Because this is not a time of joking. But for two reasons. First of all, because you're involved in something which is a mitzvah. So when you're involved in something which is in a mitzvah, you should put yourself in a totally different framework. In the ordinary framework at which you approach other issues. Other areas, it's of course, if something is serious, you'll be more serious. If something is not that serious, then, you know, you'll approach it in a different way. But a mitzvah should always be treated in an attitude of seriousness. But beyond that, there's a practical matter. Because each person there will say, yes, serious. If you ask them, you joke around, you don't want any problems to emerge, you don't want a mistake. If a mistake is made, so then it's a question whether it was done properly. And that's a very serious thing, if you're dealing with something with Kedushin, with marriage, these are very important things. I think everybody would agree. People would agree that the matter is serious, but they don't realize there's a certain carelessness. They don't realize that the attitude with which they approach it could have an effect upon the outcome. If you approach it in a lackadaisical kind of a way, you make mistakes. In that frame of mind, you'll tend to make mistakes. And it's not, even though you're serious about it, the truth of the matter is, you are serious about it in a certain level. But if you were totally serious about it, if you realized the full significance, then you wouldn't even be in the joy. Because I assure you, if you rebuke the person, if you and say, why are you kidding around? You realize this is a halakha thing, it's serious, huh? Or maybe you just don't care. You say, no, of course I care. But I'm just having a good time, relax, what's wrong with that? What does one thing have to do with the other? I would say to him, if what was transpiring was a transaction which would, could go either way, and if it went the right way, you'd become a multimillionaire. If it went the wrong way, then you'd lose all that money. Would you say the same thing? Or would you be, you'd have a totally different attitude, and you wouldn't, and people were joking around and making noise, and, those who are involved, those who are writing up the documents have to concentrate. I think your attitude would be one of total seriousness. Now, would you maintain the same attitude? What's wrong with joking around? Everything's fine, there's no problems over here. The answer is, because when something matters to you in that type of a way that it affects all of your emotions, so then you're going to maintain a different, then the seriousness will come through. And over here, it means to say that a certain part of you, I would say if a person is joking around, then he doesn't take halacha that all that seriously. It's just crazy, whatever, So, even though consciously he wouldn't maintain that position, but on an emotional level, what he's saying is that what difference does it make if it's done this way, it's done that way? They're getting married. It's a ceremony, It's like a divorce. Like he's in his own mind. That's basically, I now pronounce a man and wife. It's basically, like a little game going. He's not taking halacha. It's a reflection of the fact that he's not taking that seriously. That every particular and how it's done really does matter. There's a world of reality that halacha relates to. So the point over here is that Yaakov was aware of this. That is to say, that it was not enough merely to instruct his assistant to treat Esav with respect, but that he had to demonstrate that same emotion to them. If Yaakov, according to the Pshat and Ramban, it's a deep insight, and it's fully in line with what you're saying, that Yaakov, in fact, did express himself. He did not want to act one way, to express himself one way in front of his assistants, and get instruct them, however, because that's a high level. There are people that could do that. There are people that could understand that Yaakov really does not look at Esav in that way, but they're going to carry out the instructions because that's what has to be done. But that's a very high level. For the average individual, that's why, in families, you have to be careful, you know, and, parents will say various things around their children about different people. I mean, you know, kids in the house will pick up on everything. And it could be dangerous if they're in shul when at home they hear the parents are always making fun out of this guy. They're in shul when he sees him, he's treating him with tremendous respect and everything, and the kid is like, like amazed. What are you talking about? I didn't know you thought that way about him. Well, the point is that Yaakov, according to this pshat, Yaakov held it wasn't enough merely to instruct them to talk to you to Esav in a certain way, but he had to demonstrate that he had that emotion. If they saw that Yaakov felt that way, then they would take it seriously. No, I didn't say no. So the question about Das surgeons that sometimes joke around with his attention, the answer is that there's a time when it might be appropriate, because after a while certain things may become ordinary and not demand that type of heightened awareness. But at a time of a crisis, if they were to be they're working on a patient and it's a matter of life and death, and they were joking around at the same time, I think you'd be upset. What would you say? If they were, look, we're just doing the procedures, this and that, and they're making jokes, well, you know, whatever the jokes may be, you'd be quite upset. Now, you would say that indicates that they, to them, it's really not a matter of life and death. It's just another hunk of meat on the table over there. It could go this way, go that way, you know, chalk it up this way, chalk it up that way. That's what you'd be saying. So you'd be critical of them. Now, over here, I'm not saying that, yeah, it is a matter of life and death. That's the point. The point is that you should treat halachic issues very seriously. You should regard them in the same seriousness. It's not necessary for my point to say that every halachic transaction is equivalent to a matter of life and death. That's not the point. But the point is that the lack of seriousness, the joking around indicates, and the truth of with, where do you see this? That people do have, I've made this point before, but people do have, you see this one time a year, that people have a very innate sense of aggression towards being encumbered by the entire halakhic system. Where do you see this? Not firm. Nope. Not firm. Firm is a different phenomenon. I would say, go to the shuls on Simchas Torah. It's unbelievable how this is accepted. It's not reveling. First of all, Purim is, and I'm not justifying what's done, but there the idea of reveling and so forth, celebrating, okay, that's basically the idea. It may get out of hand. It may get out of line. Nobody, the intention was not to create a day when everybody, you know, can get drunk and, throw up all over the street, but all right, you see, that's not a rebellion against halacha, though. But on Simchas Torah, when that's the celebration of the completion of the Torah reading cycle, so that's the whole Simcha, the Simcha Shal Mitzvah, and that is a license to break down every. That's what it becomes, to break down every rule, every. Yes, every rule in the shul. They can't even what you see that. For example, they had to change the duchen, which is wrong. You're supposed to duchen in Musaf, the Kohan, the blessings of the Kohan. They are always said in Musaf when they're said. Yet on Simchas, we over here say, in Marshall we say it in Musaf. We do it properly because we observe it properly. But in all the shuls, the custom is to say it in Shachar. Why? Because everybody's drunk. Now that is a very serious prohibition for a person to daven when he's drunk. Well, if you have no choice, it's halachically sound because you're not going to have a Muslim. But the truth of the matter is, it's not that you can't. If you can't say the Birkat Kohanim in Musaf, then what does that mean? Then you can't daven Musaf. So how do they proceed in daven Musaf? yet they go ahead and proceed to daven. How can you have it both ways? If you're telling me that we're all going to be drunk, so therefore we can't say the Birkas Kohanim, so we can't daven Musaf. It's all the same thing. So there's no daven Musaf. Just can't. So why don't they come out and cancel Musaf? Because they can't do that. If they were to do that, then they're openly admitting that on this day they're just simply negating the halacha system. But then all the what they do with the tying up people's kalesim, and they carry off the chazan and the pouring of water. I've seen all these. I saw it as a kid, and I didn't know. I haven't kept up to date, but I hear that the same pranks. To say it's just a day, and everybody feels total license. After they've gotten there earlier, they have a total license now to get drunk and to do all kinds of crazy things. And that's that's saying something. It's hard for me to justify this type of a thing. Purim is different because in Purim it's not part of the framework of the davening. It's just that there is a mitzvah to have a suvah, and it is brought down that there's a point in drinking. The Rambam doesn't say to get drunk, but it's part of the celebration. So therefore, people will take it to an extreme. It's different. It doesn't express necessarily a revolt against the halachic system. But on Simchas Torah, it's in the framework of they're breaking down all of the halachos with regard to tefillah in the name of celebrating the Torah, in the name of rejoicing in the Torah. So therefore, you must say that they have these pent up emotions throughout the entire year. There's certain hostility, certain aggressiveness, and this is the opportunity to. How can a person rejoice in something like that? They're breaking down the davening and the carrying off the chazan and so forth. It's an amazing thing that this type of thing is tolerated. It really is. Think about it. It surprises me that the rabbis don't get together and put a stop to this. The mitzvah on Yom Tov is to. Ain't simcha, to rejoice with meat and with wine, but that's not to get drunk. That's to put yourself in a happy state. But that's not part of the davening. That's done in the afternoon. That's done in the morning is chetzia. The first half of the day is observed. Chetzia Hashem. The first half of the day is for davening, for prayer and for learning. The second half of the day is lachem. It's for personal. You should rejoice on the Yom Tov. With good food, with wine, and so forth. That's a separate idea. And even that, the Rambam says, is not a different kind of a simcha. It's not the simcha of drunkenness. But a person should not. There's no reason why on Simchas Torah, why on Simchas Torah do they make kiddush after they get the aliyah rather than make kiddush at the usual time when you finish with the entire davening? How does that come into the picture? It doesn't make any sense. The hakafos. The dancing and the rejoicing is around the Torah. That's a different kind of a simcha. And I say that's a very difficult. What you find again is that those people that jump into the middle and jumping and dancing with the Torah, it always struck me as being very ironic. Even as a kid, that struck me as that. I didn't know much, but I had a certain sense for ironic phenomena. It just struck me as being strange that people, I would see that people would jump and dance with the Torah and everything, and it struck me as strange because it didn't make any. These people were not people that spent the entire year learning. They had no real interest in learning throughout the entire year. Ordinary people, Orthodox Jews, whatever. But you'd imagine that. I mean, I didn't feel that type of a fervor. They were dancing and displaying a tremendous fervor. Now, what for what? For what Simchas Torah truly represents, for the love of Torah, they didn't really have that emotion. So therefore, I didn't understand. I could understand people there were those people that did learn all year and clearly manifested their love of Torah all year. So then it was to them, it made sense. I saw that it was perfect. this is the person's life. So he dances with the Torah. He's expressing it's honest. It's not phony. It's genuine. Okay. Well, that's what I'm saying. To get back to your point, that you see. That when people joke around about something, it is it's an expression of a real attitude, which normally perhaps remains hidden. Now, Yaakov in this case, according to this pshat, did not want to was being very cautious not to communicate not to communicate any type of a disrespect to Esav, because his people would pick up on it, and that could affect him. That's how careful he was in his diplomacy. It's a very good point. It makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense because people pick up on your attitude. If they sense that you yourself emotionally are not in tune with what you're saying, a lot of people need that emotion. They have to. It's not just that they're given the instruction, do such and such. All right, we'll treat him with respect, even though the guy's a jerk. Treat him with respect. That's so one level of person can respond, but most people will not show him the appropriate respect. Because then now they're in a state of ambivalence. And when emotionally they don't feel it. So when they're in that state, they can't function properly. So therefore you have to communicate a certain emotion. Okay. Now the key question over here, of course, is on Rashi. Famous Rashi. From Love on Garthi. Take a look at Rashi. You're probably familiar with this. Rashi quotes a Chazal. So Rashi says, he has Devarachar, he says, Garti, the Gemashia Taryag. The word Garti is the numerical equivalent of Taryag, interestingly enough. Same letters, which is 613. Kolomar, Lavan HaRosha Garti, that is to say, I dwelled with the wicked Lavan, the Taryag Mitzvos Shamati, and I observed the 630 commandments. And I didn't learn from his wicked ways. So first of all, there's two things in this. He's telling him two things, interestingly enough. He's telling him that he kept the 613 commandments. Now, I'm not going to touch upon that whole issue. We discussed that recently about whether the idea that the Avos kept these mitzvot is to be taken literally or not. But, it doesn't really matter. He means he kept the command. They had command. Whatever commandments they had, he kept. The Taryag means the system. The Taryag is a reference to the system. Okay. 613. But isn't it a little bit? If that's the case, of course it wouldn't. What does it mean? And I didn't learn from his wicked ways. Why do you have to mention? There's two questions over here.
In other words,
there's two questions. If he's telling him that he kept the 613 commandments, so that already includes that he obviously didn't learn from his wicked ways. So had he learned in his wicked ways, he wouldn't have kept the commandments. So it would seem to be superfluous. Superfluous. The second question is, well, this really should be the first question, is what was the concept behind telling him this? First of all, you have to realize one thing. Did he actually tell... I always get back to this question. How do you weave a message back into the process? What did, was this the message or not? Did they actually tell this to him? If that was the message, so it should have said, Kozomer, Ladonili Esav, because this is a very important idea. In love on Garti, Vitayak Mishvashvati, Veloli Marati, Vimas Varayim. Why doesn't the Pusik state that? That always intrigues me. Because when Rashi comes in, we did that yesterday. Rashi comes in and makes certain changes, or changes the sense. Like, you know, the sense of the pasuk yesterday was the Lavan. But Lavan was being very friendly, you know, and embracing him. And Rashi makes this criticizing him, changing the sense. Here too, it's not changing the sense, but it's an important piece of information. It's a very important piece of information that we really are supposed to know about, if this was the message. Because that's what we're... Everything else would be Vayihi Shavachamor. He tells him what he has. And he has a lot of wealth, a lot of animals, the servants, etc. And I've sent messengers to tell my master in order to find favor in his eyes, and so forth. Whatever is essential is being mentioned. Why isn't this being mentioned? But the most important question of all is, what's the point of it? What is the strategy behind telling him that? That he kept the mitzvah. How does this fit into his plan? Of course, everything that Yaakov did over here is part of his plan of how to best deal with someone like Esav. Why would Esav be impressed? Our understanding is that Esav is someone who had renounced the mitzvah. If it, of course, if it's just the opposite, if Esav is coming and sending messengers to Yaakov, and Yaakov is the individual who has the power, and Esav has strayed from the path, and he wants to impress Yaakov, then it makes sense. Tell the message, tell Yaakov that I did tshuva, I'm Baal tshuva, and I returned, and I kept the mitzvah. That would make sense in reverse, right? Because that's something which Yaakov would respect. But to tell Esav that I dwelt with Lavan and I kept the mitzvah, so why would Esav care about that? Well, what's the point? Well, why tell him that? How is that going to help the situation one way or another? I'm assuming that the underlying objective over here is diplomacy, to save himself from danger. So what he's saying over here is calculated to save himself from death's primary objective. Now the question then would be, how would this message that he kept the mitzvot, how would this help his purpose? Why would this impress somebody like Esau, who's not interested in mitzvot? That's the question. If anything, he recognized that Yaakov had received the blessings and so on and so forth, whatever. Yaakov had gotten the better of the situation was due to the because of his nature. He was a Yoshev Ohalim. He was the person who studied the Torah, who kept the mitzvot. It seems to be that wasn't incidental. Why bring that one up? That goes back, now you're bringing up the whole situation of the past, where he received more favorable treatment, and he did part of it had to do with the fact that he was the tzaddik. He was the tzaddik, and Russia was a wicked person, and the wicked person, of course, hates the tzaddik. That's why Esav, the Gemara says, it's like a halacha, the halachi. Esav son Eli Yaakov. Esav hates Yaakov. That's what it's an interesting Gemara. I think people misunderstand it. Because you does say it's a halacha. It's like a law, a dictate of reality. Esav son Eli Yaakov, that Esav hates Yaakov. So I think people misunderstand it. They take it to mean that anti-Semitism is merely the only. It's an automatic. It's inevitable, and it's a result of the wickedness of the anti-Semite. As though the Jews play no role whatsoever. That's like the Jews. There's a certain segment of Jews that look at the world that way. All Jews basically are good, and all Gentiles are basically bad. So therefore, anti-Semitism is a result of the evil of the Gentiles. In other words, they never look into themselves to see whether. I'm not blaming Jews for anti-Semitism, obviously, but the question does remain whether it's purely something which is inevitable and it can't be avoided, or whether it does have to do with certain types of behaviors in the Jews themselves. It's a very important question. But at all events, there is this concept that Esav hates Yaakov. Esav hates Yaakov means Yaakov who represents mitzvah. Yeah, the Torah mitzvahs, and Esav who represents, and the reason is very clear, because he's rejected. And when a person rejects an ideal, he's always going to hate the idealist. That's always the case. That's a natural result. Any person who's given up ideals will always have a certain animosity. All right, it could be a high-level person that's very honest and says that, look, I respect the idealist, but I can't help it. But generally speaking, he's going to naturally hate the idealist, because the idealist is always it's an affront to his own ego. It's a reminder of the fact he can't accept the fact that he's inferior, that there's an ideal out there that he can't live up to. So therefore, he rationalizes and he says that that's not really the ideal. Now, when you see somebody else that actually does keep it, so that refutes what he's saying. You see that there is an ideal, that this person is capable of doing it. So he hates that person. Now, why flaunt mitzvot in this place? I say Moshe is suggesting something else. That, quite separate from this is not part of the strategy then, what you're saying. We're assuming that every point in the message is part of the strategy. The reason I say this is because throughout history, this has always been taken, this parsha itself has been taken to be more than just a recounting of an event. that is supposed to be the blueprint on the most perfect way in which the Jews are supposed to relate to situations of oppression. This is the Jew versus the anti-Semite. And throughout the centuries, whenever the Jew, you know, the Gedolim, right, they had to confront the Gentile authorities before they would do so, they would take out the Chumash and study this parsha, because it contains all the ideas which keep recurring throughout history. So what we're going to learn is a very interesting parsha. What we're going to be learning about over here is something which is not just, you know, from the past, but it's relevant. This is my name. Now, Moshe, what you're saying, what you're saying is perfectly reasonable, that somebody like Yaakov would want to communicate the idea that one can retain the system and be a high-level individual even when he's living together in a situation with love. That is true. It's a very important point over there. Because he had to deal with love, which means that he had to engage in types of activities which he, of deceit. He had to practice the art of deceit in a righteous kind of a way. And yet he was able to do so. I mean, the challenges that Yaakov faced were much more complicated than any of the other Avos. That's why the Chazal referred to Yaakov as the Mechir Shev Avos, the most perfected of the Avos, in terms of truth. Because he had to confront the world on his own terms. He had to deal with deceivers. And he had to utilize the same types of methods, but do so in a way which was justified. It's much easier to sit back. It's much easier. It's like I always give the example. There are certain rabbis out there on the frontier. You know, Orthodox rabbis, and but they're dealing with people from non-religious backgrounds, and they have a lot. There's a lot of questions and problems, and you can't just give a simple pshat. You know, like you can't be machmir, you can't be stringent. But there is room, and you have to look in, because then you'll just lose all the people. On the other hand, you can't compromise. You can't give up the principles. But in between, to learn exactly, to use your intelligence to the utmost degree, to work out a solution which is a leniency, but it's a leniency within the framework of the halachic system, which is acceptable and appropriate to the situation without the compromise, and that requires the greatest skill. It's easy, it's a fact. A person is in New York and in Borough Park, and he has a very orthodox community, and they only want to hear the most stringent pronouncement. So it's simple. Whatever you tell them to do, they'll do. And if it's more chumrah, if it's more stringent, the better. And they tend to look down when they hear about a rabbi that allowed the people to do such and such on Shabbos, and he did it with calculation in order to avoid them doing a serious sitter. If, even though it's halachically, you can't say that it's wrong, but they laugh at this. They laugh at such a thing. They look down and they frown. The truth is that I'm assuming now that what the person did was done, you know, because there are those who just compromise. I'm saying it's not a compromise. But that requires that you're a higher degree of chachmah, to be able to take the system and to apply it to all the difficult situations where there's challenges, where people want to break it down. If you don't break it down, you maintain it, then you attach them to halacha within the boundary line. That's a higher degree of the chachma. And the same is with Yaakov. But Yaakov, it's one thing to be ethical in a company where everything is set up in a certain way. You know, all the rules are set up in a certain way. They want you to behave in this way, and there's no one is threatening. But to be in a situation where every day there's a different type of a scheme, and some of those schemes there is room for you to maneuver, and some you can't. I mean, you have to know every situation where the boundary line is, and to be able to do so, that's the greatest challenge. To your sense of ethics, not to lose your sense of ethics, and not to lose your compass. That's what Yaakov had to contend with. So what Moshe is saying is very true. Then he communicated an idea to Esav that even in that situation, you could still retain your commitment to Allah. It doesn't mean that you have to give up the physical world. It's a very brilliant point.
Why would you want to talk about it?
That's the question. That's the only question. Oh. The idea itself would be beautiful. Now, the idea would be beautiful because a man like Esav is an individual who lusts after the material, and in his mind, you can't have both. You can't have both. You can't be successful in this world. That's his concept. that you can't be successful, you can't enjoy the fruits of this world unless you abandon the other one. To him it was basically a very nice point. I hadn't thought of it this way before. It's a very nice point. That's why he gave up Judaism. He gave up mitzvot because he opted. He made a decision. It's this world. And Yaakov was telling him that you can make it in this world too. Don't think you have to give up this world. If you apply your intelligence, if you use your chachma, then even in a situation with a person like a lover, because that's what Esav is saying. You see that in order to make it in this world, there's a bunch of cutthroats out there. So you got to be like them. You can't go into politics and be ethical because there's a bunch of cutthroats out there. So if you decide you make that decision, that's it. Forget about it. You got to give up ethics, give up truth, and that's it. Because you want power. And Yaakov shows no. You can go out there and you can deal with these people. And he wound up with tremendous wealth. It fit him beautifully. And look at all the wealth that I accumulated. I accumulated everything. And I did so because our system is such that you could use your intelligence and we're not inhibited because most people think that a religion... That's what he told... He alluded to this idea, by the way, when he first confronted Rachel. So he said, to tell your father that I am the brother of... I am the brother of your father, right? What's the exact wording? It's in... when he meets Rachel, it says, Vayaged Yaakov and Rachel. Yaakov told Rachel, Ki achi aviyahu, that he's the brother of her father. It's not literally the brother. The term brother is relative. Karav, Rashi says. V'chiven Rivkahu, and that he was the son of Rivka. Now Rashi says that he was communicating an idea. There's a medrash here, an implication. Umedrash Rashi says, Im l'ramah subah, if he's coming at me with deceit, gamani achiv b'ramah, then I too, I'm his brother. I can be his brother. I'm his brother, and if I can practice deceit just as well as him. If he's coming at me with deceit, then I'm his brother in deceit. He was communicating two messengers, because he was saying, I could be the brother, I could be defined. He was really defining himself. What am I? I am both the son of Rivka. But if he is an Adam Kasher, if he's a righteous person, Gamani ben Rivka, Achosa, then I am the son of Rivka, his Achosa Akshera, his righteous sister. So it's interesting, he gave a whole definition of himself. It's a whole new definition. Because in most cases, most persons are either one or the other. Either you're a righteous person, in which case you're removed from, you can't practice the art of deceit. Even in a situation where it's mandated, because most people's righteousness is based upon certain very powerful emotions, and it's not pure rationality. And those same emotions, which lead them to do good deeds, they feel a certain repulsion against practicing deceit, but deceit sometimes rationality dictates that this is the right thing to do. Like you see, he had to lie to his father. Lying to his father in that case was the ethical thing to do. So he told him, you're dealing with a new type of an individual. It's a different type of a person. It all depends. I'll react by the situation. I am basically the son of Rivka, of Shera. That's what I'd like to be. If you relate to me that way, then you'll see a person who'll respond with righteousness. But if you'll treat me with deceit, don't think that because the Rasha always likes to deal with the Tzaddik because he has an advantage. Because he can break all the rules, and the other person is bound by the rules. You see that throughout history. You see that today, in many cases. You see these democracies, they make these treaties with these ruthless dictators. Of course, the dictators are laughing, they can't wait to break it. And then the democratic leaders, we have ethics, we have principles, we can't just break a treaty. So, of course, in such a situation, the other party has the upper hand. Yaakov was different. Now, that's what he was, according to Moshe, that's what he was communicating to Esau. You made a big mistake. Because you opted for the physical world. And you thought that in order to have the physical world, you had to give up Taryag. But you don't understand the nature of Taryag. The nature of Taryag is a totally different kind of a system. It doesn't demand that you pacifism. That you just become, you just lay down and let the other guy take advantage of you. If you use your intelligence correctly, then you can succeed. That's a brilliant idea. The only problem that we have, as Rich said, is that how does that fit into the strategy? How does that fit into the strategy of Yaakov? That would only make sense if his fear is, see, if I'm encountering Esav and I'm afraid that he might regard me in a certain light because of what I learned from Lavan, so it makes sense. But the hatred is there from pre-Lavan. I'm trying to deal with the hatred that's from pre-Lavan situation, right? I'm trying to remove a hatred that existed pre-Lavan. So what good is it to tell him that I didn't learn anything from Lavan? It's not anything that I would have learned from Lavan that would have determined this in the first place. It's a little bit difficult. Very important to realize that what we read, for many, many reasons, the Torah cannot be read like an ordinary book, obviously. But you have to bear in mind many things. That the words of the Torah, the ideas of the Torah, have different levels. You know, the simple level of the pshat, but then it's constructed. The divine wisdom is constructed in such a way so that a further analysis will yield more ideas. But simply, I mean, certain basic rules have to be understood. Often the Torah will record a meeting and a conversation between two people. And he said to them, Avram said to Abimelech, and so on and so forth. You have to realize that even in such a case, where the Torah records a conversation, it's not the same way that a journalistic account would be presented. It doesn't mean that this is the full gist of every word that was said. You know, because sometimes they got together and there was one sentence, and then he left. And then the Torah says, then he left. That's all they said. I mean, the Torah is recording the essence, the gist of what was communicated. It doesn't. It's not recording it in a documentary kind of fashion. It's just that's an important point to bear in mind. They must have said more things to each other, but this was the gist. This was the gist, and not to say that he didn't use those words. Well, what the Torah is quoting is correct, but summing up the essential. Now, the expression, well, Yaakov over here chose the expression in love on Garti. All it means is that I sojourned. I dwelled. The term Garti implies something which is not permanent, transitory. I dwelled with him, so forth. But yeah, it carries another idea. It carries a deeper idea. Somehow or other, it has to carry this idea. There's a connotation over here as well, and Rashi Chazal picked up on that. The connotation leads them to the conclusion that this is what he said. He didn't say it openly, but he communicated the idea. Garti is the gematria tayyar. And he communicated to him in one way or another, although this was not to be said directly, that he kept the mitzvot and didn't learn from his evil ways. Alright? It's interesting. After we explain it, we should try and go back to the wording. Where's the implication? It doesn't seem to be in any way related to the wording. The wording simply is telling him a fact that he dwelled with Lavan and tarried until now. But let's get back to our question. Our question was that everything was being done over here for a purpose, a diplomatic purpose, to assuage Esau. And yet, he saw fit to tell him about the fact that he kept the mitzvot, and we really couldn't understand how this would impress somebody like Esau who had rejected the mitzvot. So, there's an important idea over here, and that's where we left off. I think the Chait Magnus, right? Chait gave an idea many years ago. I'll say it over. I think it's very worthwhile to hear. The reason I'm mentioning it is because it's not my own. And let's consider it. I think it's a very interesting idea. It leads us into many nice areas. But he tied it back to the whole question of anti-Semitism. Because we're looking we're trying to understand this in the universal framework, that Esav is basically the quintessential anti-Semite, as we said, that it's a halacha. Chazal say that it's a law, that Esav hates Yaakov, Esav soni Yaakov. Now what is the reason for that law? We can't assume that it's a predetermined thing, that a Gentile, by nature, just has a certain gene, an anti-Semitic gene in him. I don't think that makes any sense, right? So the question is, what was the attitude of Chazal, of the rabbis, of the Talmud? What was their understanding of the cause of anti-Semitism? Now, I think somebody alluded to it yesterday. I'm not mistaken. I think it was the Tani was mentioning this. But Chazal had an expression. They incorporated this idea into a explanation of the term Sinai. Why was the Torah given as the Har Sinai? The name Sinai had a significance. That the term is related to the word Sinai. Sinai is related to Sinai, hatred. And it says, because Nisham Yata Sinai L'chol HaOlam. Because from there, hatred went forth to the entire world. That's a very amazing idea. Meaning to say that you would think that people have a problem with this. God gave the Jews the Torah, but that caused hatred. Of course, why would God want to cause hatred in the world? Right? And what type of a hatred? So it means like this, that in spite of the fact that you have to understand people on a deeper level, very often the position that they're maintaining on the conscious level is not their true state of mind. In fact, it could be quite the opposite. So it means to say that the underlying cause of the hatred of the Jew, the sinner, is Torah. Is Torah. They hate the Jew because of Torah. Which means to say that was a slap in the face to the entire world. That there's an envy. That they envy the Jew. Because the Jewish, the fact of the matter is that the Jews are the people that are chosen by God, or God chose a particular people to a specific mission, and that people happen to be the Jews, and the other people that were not chosen have an envy, and they want to go. Now the fact that this may sound astounding to a person, because you say no, that they don't like the Torah, they don't want to keep the Torah. Of course they're in conflict about the Torah. That's another idea that was expressed by Chazal, that God went to the other nations and they all asked, what are the commandments and so forth.
Yeah.
And as soon as they heard that there's restrictions, thou shalt not kill and so on and so forth, they rejected. So then, of course, the answer is that they're in a state of conflict. And that's what most people want to have. They want to have the glory. They want to have the glory and the honor of being the people of the Torah, but they don't want to be encumbered by the restrictions. So that isn't that exactly what Christianity is all about, psychologically? It's an attempt to say, what are they saying? That the Jews were rejected. They can't tell the truth of the matter is, when they're saying the Jews were rejected unconsciously, what they're saying is that the Jews were chosen. But they can't accept that idea. That's an affront to them. So the idea is switched over. You're rejected and we have replaced you. We have the chosen ones. But of course, the mitzvot is not because we are inferior. We're inferior and we can't do it. That's because you were inferior and you needed the mitzvot. But now that we've reached this advanced stage of development where we're so advanced, we don't need the mitzvot. So it works. But you see from that, and you see Islam. I mean, the major religions of the world are all rooted in Torah. Everybody agrees that the Torah is divine. All the Christianity and Islam, they all agree that the Torah is divine. And they all have that same idea that the Jews, who are the chosen people, somehow messed up and rejected, and they're the replacement, they're the real chosen people. So this shows you one limiting point. This is the sinner. The hatred is because the existence of the Jew. Now the problem is the Christians hoped the alive of the Jews would just now go away. They would just they would suffer. They took the exile. They used it for their own purposes. The fact that the Jews contributed to it, made it miserable, made their lives miserable because they had rejected the Christianity. But the existence of the Jew the Jew himself represents the idea that he was chosen, he was given the Torah. And the Gentile is envious of that, because insofar as he's a human being, insofar as he has a mind, there's a part of him that recognizes that the highest part of man is the mind, and that knowledge is the greatest good. Everybody recognizes that knowledge is the greatest good, and that's why people are up. That's why the real envy, even though people don't live their lives that way, and of course they don't. An Einstein will not get the kind of a salary that favorite basketball player, whatever. Because in practically speaking, people live by their emotions, but underneath it, the true respect, the real respect that people have, no one is gonna say that Michael Jordan is on a higher level than an Einstein. I mean, each person, insofar as human being, will recognize the fact that the real greatness is the person who has the knowledge. And that's true. And that's the basis of the idea that Misham Yotza Sinu L'Chol HaOlam. At a certain level, people there's an envy. But Chazal say that. Chazal say that the hatred that the Am Haaretz, the ignoramus, has for the Talmud Chacham, for the Torah scholar, is greater than the hatred that the Gentiles have for the Jews. Which indicates that what is greater? What's the connection? That they both have the same source. There is a certain envy that an ignoramus has for a Talmud Chacham. It's because he feels deprived. He feels every person recognizes that knowledge is the highest. It doesn't mean he'll fashion his life on the basis of that, but emotionally there's that recognition. The worst thing you can say to a person is not that he's ugly, or that he's greedy, or that he's obnoxious. The worst insult is you're stupid. That's the worst thing. And that's true for anyone. That's true even if the guy is not so, if the guy, you'll say, but that should, the fact that you say I'm stupid, that should only bother somebody who's an intellectual, who's a scholar, who values knowledge, but it bothers them. And the best, you see the highest praise, even in sports, when the sports kids, because they always have to build it up into something more than what it just is. Again, it's purely physical. What a smart play, he's brilliant. Everything, it becomes a matter of, why are they using terminology like, it's not brilliant. There's no real brilliance involved. I mean, the guy, because you hear these people talking after the game, there's no, you don't hear him as brilliant. So whatever it is, it's a different type of thing. I mean, of course, the person has mastered the various moves. So of course, he was in the right place at the right time, made the right pass, whatever it is, but that's not because of, it's not what we have in mind when we think about brilliance, about working out a plan and an idea. But nevertheless, they're looking for that type of thing because that's the only, they can't apply anything of tremendous value to something which is purely instinctual and physical. They have to elevate it until they can find some way. And that's why they'll say it about any sport. In any sport, even in boxing, where it's basically the ability to knock out, and all that, he's brilliant, brilliant move. Genius, plan, brilliant. It was all brilliant. Everything is brilliant. It's because, and the worst thing, again, even with a person like that, the best, the biggest compliment is to tell that was a smart move. Smart move. Why is that the biggest compliment that you can tell a person? Because that is truly what a person values the most. And that's what he really wants the most. And that's why people laugh. That's why people laugh at the scholar, the egghead. They have all these different types of expressions. Because they're laughing because they're trying to put it down. Because there's a certain envy. So that's the concept of Esav Sone Le'Yaakov. In fact, you have to realize that the conscious behavior, the fact that people hate the Jews, this is an interesting observation made by no less a person than Sigmund Freud. In one of his books, he said that, something like this, I'm paraphrasing, that ever since the Jews proclaimed that they were the chosen people a few thousand years ago, because the rest of the world has acted as if deep down they truly believe it. They really believe it. What does it mean? I mean, all the persecution of the Jew is based upon an attempt to deny something which they believe in their gut, that the Jews are chosen. Because if they think it's nonsense, see, when people make a claim to superiority and the rest of the world thinks it's nonsense, it doesn't bother you, so fine, let them have their country. As I said, I always said the French consider themselves to be an elite, superior people, but there's never been anti-Frenchism at home. No one ever attempted to wipe out the French, but the Jews have been subjected. What's that? That's different types of things. That's European, yeah. The countries have been fighting up and back, but they didn't. Why? Hitler, when he took over France, did he have a policy of genocide to wipe out all the French, to destroy French culture? They had a policy to destroy the Jews. The war against France was territorial and so forth, and other types of things. But he respected the French culture. But he wasn't threatened by it. So the behavior of the world is an indication that deep down they can't tolerate the idea that the Jews are superior. Now that's step number one. If that is the case, that the underlying cause of the hatred is the fact that the Jew, that's why it's the person of the Jew, by the way, the person of the Jew. It doesn't matter how the Jew lives, whether the Jew is religious or not, either. The hatred will be directed against the fact because he's the Jew, he's identified. In the mind of the Gentile, he's identified with the fact that the Gentile was rejected. He was given Torah. It doesn't matter. The anti-Semite hates all Jews equally. It doesn't matter whether he's assimilated or religious. If the underlying cause of the anti-Semitism is the fact that the Jew was given the Torah and the mitzvah, and it's an affront to the Gentile, so then if anything the question now becomes stronger: why would Yaakov choose to convey that message to him? Wouldn't that sort of be arousing his jealousy? It's arousing the jealousy. That's what Chazal say something, I don't know the exact terminology, that a person who learns, again, a common person who learns in front of an Am Haaretz, in front of an ignoramus, it's like he's having relations, like a boel arusasa, right? Which it means to say it is akin, it's as though he would be, arusasa is his betrothed. If the woman is, he's betrothed or in marriage, but he hasn't consummated the marriage yet. We do the entire marriage ceremony in one, you know, in one occasion, one event today, but they used to break it up. First he'd betroth her, and then she'd have like 12 months to get, you know, so they wouldn't live together as man and wife. It would just be the transaction of betrothal. Then the final phase of the marriage, when she would come to his house, would be 12 months later. Now there's a period of time in between, would be the moment like the greatest desire. He's betrothed there, and now he's anticipating. So the rabbis say that if you learn Torah in front of an Am Haaretz, it is as though you are having sexual relations with his betrothed in his face, like you're flaunting him, like the worst possible thing you could do to him. Which indicates that they are comparing Torah to his betrothed, which means that is the greatest object of his desire. In spite of everything that you see around you, what a person truly desires the most, if his true thought could come to the surface, would be knowledge. And when he's an ignoramus, it bothers him. It's a blow to his own ego that he's ignorant, and therefore, unless he checks the foot, there's certain tendencies. I mean, just because he's ignoramus doesn't mean he can respect the Torah scholar. Just saying, but the natural tendency of a person who doesn't have control over these emotions, who's unwilling to recognize, you know, his own limitations, so he's naturally going to have a hatred. When he sees the other person learning, he feels inferior. That's what he wants to do. And he feels that he can't have it. He's prevented from having it. So it's like the person is taking his own betrothed. That's the way Chazal put it, to show you how great is the desire of the ordinary person for Torah knowledge. So if that's the case, then the question becomes even stronger. So why would Yaakov, whose objective over here was to defuse the hatred, why would he choose a message which, if anything, according to this analysis of Chazal, is only going to make the hatred even stronger? I think it's a very deep insight. And he said that it is true that the fact that the Jews have the Torah and the Mitzvot is the cause of it's the underlying cause of the hatred. But the way the person functions is that since every person has a conscience, every human being has a conscience, and he can't act, he just simply can't act out his emotions until he's found a way of justifying it. He has to justify it. That's why you see that every campaign, every anti-Semitic the campaign against the Jews always is preceded by a propaganda campaign. They see how the Germans, how they in the Sturmer and his newspaper artist, he would depict the Jews the way the Jews were depicted as bloodsuckers.